I've been truly blessed to be able to go to Israel. It's hard to describe how illuminating it is for the scriptures when you've been there. If I had a checkbook big enough, you know, I would take you all to experience it. But the best I can do is try to share some things in these lessons that I've been giving to show you some of the pictures and perhaps give you some glimpse of that feeling that you get when you're there. It's just it's a great place to visit if you're a Bible scholar, a Bible student. And so that's one of the lessons I'm going to do tonight. One of my favorite places to visit is in Israel is the Temple Mount. The Jews refer to the mount as the Temple Mount because that's where the temples were built. It's the large platform that you see walled here. It's hard to, sometimes the illustrations that are done help you a little bit better, but it's hard to realize the topography any longer because the city has filled in so much, plus the city has raised over the centuries. And so it's really hard to appreciate elevations. And but this is essentially is a big box that's sitting on a hill. The hill is very rounded, and of course the sides have to be much deeper to compensate, but it's just a big box sitting on the hill. The Muslims, of course, they do not believe there was a temple, and so they call it the Haram-e-Sharif, which means noble sanctuary. The Muslims were given control of the Temple Mount after the Six-Day War in 1967. And though today it's policed by Israelis, it's in the control of the Muslims, of the Waqf. It's erected. Several of the things that are erected on that big box, that big platform, are the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is on the southern side of the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock. These things are not plugging in like they should, so I apologize. The Dome of the Rock is, of course, in the center. It is not a mosque. It's merely a covering for the rock that is there. In the southeast corner is the Marwani Prayer Hall, and these are the stairs that lead down to it, and it occupies underground this whole corner. It was originally called Solomon's Stables, but that's a name that was given during the Crusades. Solomon never had a horse down there, but that's what it was called during the Crusades. Jews and Gentiles are allowed up on the Temple Mount, but you cannot perform any kind of religious act. You can't take a Bible. You can't do any kind of act of worship. You can't pray. You can't take maps up there. And they will search your belongings to make sure that you don't have any infractions against those rules. So any non-Muslim just can't worship, pray, or study. All that is concentrated on the Western Wall. And the Western Wall, it's right down here. There's a plaza here. So that's the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall that you hear about. And it's right down here in the corner. So that's the closest the Jews can get to where the temple once stood, which is on this area right here. The Dome of the Rock, which is just above the wall with the gold dome, it covers the bedrock of Mount Moriah. And Mount Moriah is the summit of the hill. That's the highest point. This is the highest point of this whole hill, which makes its way south, and it goes downhill gradually. First is the Ophel that you read about in the Bible. The next is the city of David. And it goes all the way down to En Rogel, which is the spring down at the bottom. And so it's a very long, it's shaped a lot like Florida flipped, if you looked at it without any buildings there. And so that's the highest point. That's where the rock is covered. Supposedly, that's where Abraham sacrificed Isaac. He came to Mount Moriah to do that. And, of course, the subsequent temples sat on top of that rock. As you know, there were three temples built. The first one, of course, was Solomon's Temple. It was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586, and that was followed by the exiles who came back and rebuilt it under Zerubbabel. After the 70 years of exile, Then the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees during between the Testaments came into power, and they added on that bottom, that orange section you see up here. And then, of course, Herod's temple, which kept enlarging, and this is what it is today without these buildings down here. The Temple Mount today, and you can see the Dome of the Rock sitting there. Even though the walls and the gates have been rebuilt over the centuries around that perimeter, it's an immense complex. Those walls have been rebuilt, but that platform is basically the same one that was there from early on, from Herod's period, from the time of Christ. So obviously this is an artist's rendering of the Temple Mount in Jesus' day. And you can see this is the southern wall. Here's the Mount of Olives. Here's the western wall. And of course, there's the temple itself sitting on top of the platform or the Temple Mount. According to John chapter 2, verse 20, it took 46 years for the Jews to build this. That construction went on much longer than Herod's lifetime, that it continued on. And so, as I was saying, the walls and the gates have been rebuilt over the centuries, but they're approximately in the same location because we're still building on top of that same box. Some of the gates have changed. Some of the walls are slightly in different places. So when you look across from the Mount of Olives, you pretty much see what would have been seen when Jesus stood there and looked across the map, across the Kidron Valley, except you wouldn't see the Muslim memorial there on the rock. But as far as the platform itself, you're seeing pretty much what it would have looked like from the Mount of Olives. And of course, the western part of the city up here on the hill would not have been nearly as populated. There are two similar incidences that were repeated in the life of Christ that involved the temple. One took place at the beginning of Jesus' ministry and the other at the end of his ministry. And they're referred to as the cleansing of the temple. That's usually the little subhead that's in your Bible. The first one's found in John chapter 2. And the last one is mentioned by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The week before Jesus was crucified. So I just wanted to look at those two incidences a little bit closer. In John chapter 2, Jesus was making one of his many visits to the temple. On this occasion, it was for Passover. And in John chapter 2 and verse 14, it tells us, he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers seated at their tables. So let's try to understand the scene, visualize this. According to the Passover customs, each family coming to worship in Jerusalem would bring a paschal or a Passover lamb for sacrifice at the altar, at the temple. And keep in mind, Jews are coming from great distances to worship in Jerusalem. It was not really practical to bring an animal from home if you were coming from a great distance, especially if the animal had to be without spot or blemish, because the risk of an animal being injured or suffering some disease along the way would make that not the wisest thing to do. It may make it in vain. And so it made more sense, if you were coming a great distance to Jerusalem, to simply purchase an animal once you got there. There would have been a number of places where animals could be acquired, but evidently it was possible to make the purchase right in the temple precinct itself, from this account. Now, we don't know when that practice began, but at one point the merchandising moved from outside to inside the temple precinct. And John confirms this by saying that Jesus found this going on in the temple. Now, he doesn't mean in the specific temple itself, where the holy place and the most holy place and the mercy seat were, but he's referring to the Temple Mount. So let me familiarize you a little bit with the structure. We've been seeing some pictures of it, but let's look at some more details. It was rebuilt by Herod. Herod was a great builder. He built his whole reign. It was nothing but building palaces and fortresses. And, of course, his greatest thing that he built was the rebuilding of the temple. It was a significantly enlarged area that he took up. He maintained the essence and the essentials of the temple, but he added much more to it. And so he made sure he appeased to the Jewish authorities. The Jews never really trusted him because he wasn't Jewish. He was Idumean. So he was always suspect. And so he made sure he appeased them. He was a real politician. But he also incorporated Roman elements into the temple because he was a client king. A client king is any king that was under the Roman Empire. You know, they were supposed to send tribute and supplies to Rome to make sure you kept Caesar happy. And they're referred to as client kings. And so he was very loyal to Caesar. The Temple Mount covered that he built in this big square that we've been looking at covers approximately 35 acres. And so he expanded it on three sides. He couldn't expand it on this side because it drops off into the Kidron Valley. So he did it on the south, on the west, and on the north. The southern facade, which is down here, we're going to be moving around this with different images, but this is the southern facade. Here's the Kidron Valley. So on the southern side, there were two entrances for people. Anything this big with that many people coming into it, you had to have multiple entrances. And so that he accommodated people that in that way. So this one had two. There was, I can see there's the double gate and the triple gate. Through these, you would go up ramps that would lead up into the plaza itself. The western wall, and this one's a little blurry and I apologize. This is the western wall. The southern wall is over on the other side of this. Here's the western wall. So there were four different entrances on this side of the Temple Mount. And they're named after archaeologists because four different archaeologists discovered them. The first one is Warren's Gate. It was a street level gate that had staircases inside that led up to the top of the Temple Mount. The next one is Wilson's Arch, and you can see it led directly to the Temple Mount on the top level, but it connected to this bridge which went across the Tyropian Valley, or the Central Valley here, and went across and met up with the city and the architecture on the Western Hill. The next the third entrance is Barclay's Gate. It was another one on street level. Now keep in mind, this street level is 20, the original street level is 20 feet lower than today. When you stand on the western wall, you are 20 feet higher than Jesus would have been. That's how much the city has filled in over the centuries. Down in the southern end, we'll see some pictures where that it's been taken all the way down to the level, the first century level. But this other area is still much higher. And so Barclay's Gate, again, it's another one that's on street level that would have led up into staircase that would have led up to the top. And then finally is Robinson's Arch, which was a massive staircase on the southwest corner. It led up to the top into the Royal Stoa. This is the portion that is very much like a Roman temple. It was very Romanesque looking. And so the staircase led right up into that. We've got some other pictures. Here's just to show you what some of these look like today. Notice Wilson's Arch. It was all these passageway, the bridge that led across, and all these arches here. And right here, and this one right here, here's what it looks like today. There's the arch. This is the section. So the western wall is right here. The Wailing Wall is when you stand at the Wailing Wall or the western wall, you're right there. And you can turn to the left and actually go under Wilson's Arch. Today it's a place where the Jews study. These are bookcases. There's all sorts of Torah and Mishnah and all kinds of books of Judaism. And so you can see some of them have on their prayer shawls. They're wearing their yarmulkes. Some have the phylacteries, the boxes on their foreheads or wrapped around their arms. Many of them will either stand at a podium or sit in chairs against this wall and, you know, they rock as they read the Torah and pray to God. That's as close as they can get to the temple. where the temple was. And so that's why they choose those spots. And then Robinson's Arch. Here's another artist rendering of that massive. You can see how massive a staircase that was. And of course, this led right into the top of the Temple Mount, in the end of the Royal Stoa. This is the southern wall. And so notice this area right here, the beginning of the arch, and these little stones that stick out here, because here's what it looks like today. Sorry. Here it is today. There's those little stones, the beginning of the arch. Here's just the beginning of it. So there's portions that still exist today. And of course, the wall has been rebuilt, but many of the stones have been put back. Anything that has a frame around it is a Herodian stone. It's original to first century. And you'll see those sometimes together because those were not torn down. Other times you'll see them reused, repurposed in other places. So once you get to the top of Robinson's Arch, you enter the Royal Stoa, which was just a huge, stoa means colonnade. And so it was just a huge colonnade of massive columns. There were four rows of pillars. I think Josephus says that three men with their arms extended, it would take three men to reach around the column. So these were pretty extensive stonework. There was 162 pillars. They were 50 feet tall. The ones in the center went up even higher. There's, if you're in the Royal Stoa, looking across the plaza to the temple itself. Now going out, this is the southern. The stoa is on the southern end of the Temple Mount. As you go east and west on the perimeter, on the wall around, it's a colonnade that completely wraps the Temple Mount. On the east side, that colonnade is referred to in the New Testament as Solomon's Porch. There was a gate on there's speculation on where the gates were on the eastern side. Remember, that's the one that drops off into the Kidron. So it's they're not real sure exactly where things were. But they think there was a Shushan gate down in the very end. We also read that Jesus was by the beautiful gate or the golden gate. So those were somewhere on that eastern wall. The northern wall featured a sheep gate, which made sense because you're closest to the temple itself for sacrificing. You had to have a way to bring the animals in. So this is the northern wall. So this doesn't show a gate, but there had to have been some kind of gates in this area. Here's one here. But again, some of those are speculative because it's all been rebuilt. But on the northern wall, there was a gate here in the corner that led to the Pool of Israel. And then beyond that was the Bethesda Pool, which is also in the New Testament. The northern wall's biggest architectural feature was the Antonio Fortress, which is on that corner right here. Here's a detail of it. It had four towers. That's where the Roman soldiers, of course, would be garrisoned. It's possibly where Jesus was tortured. It's where Paul was taken when the riot started at the Temple Mount, and he was taken by the captain into the fortress. It would have been that same place. It was named Antonio Fortress. It was named after Mark Antony because he and Herod were buddies. He supported Mark Antony through a lot of his campaigns, military campaigns. So on that covers the walls and the entrances around it. On the plaza itself, you can see here's the two entrances when you come in, the triple gate or the double gate, how far you had to walk up and to come into the plaza itself. Again, there's speculation on how this was divided, but there was some kind of a wall or partition that went around the plaza. Gentiles were allowed in the southern tip, the southern area of the plaza, but they couldn't go past this gate. The closest you got to the temple was that wall. And we know that there was some kind of a petition because there were signs put up that said, if you pass this, you could be killed. You could be executed. We read in the New Testament about temple guards coming to settle disputes or to maintain security. And so there were probably guards at these gates to make sure that Gentiles would not pass through there and thus defile the temple. any further. But they were allowed in this southern portion. There is a lot of architecture in the temple proper. We have this opening gate. This could have been the Golden Gate or the Beautiful Gate. This opens into a large courtyard called the Court of the Women. This is where contributions were made. This is where Jesus would have seen the widow with her two mites put in the treasury. Then there was another massive gate called the Nicanor Gate. It was a staircase up to that. The Levites would stand on these steps and sing psalms. Once you pass through this gate, the left side was the altar. The right side was where they slaughtered the animals. Beyond that was the laver for washing. And then you go up another staircase into the temple itself. There were 12 steps up to the temple, and there were massive columns that held up the porch. Around the temple itself, you know, there was just two rooms, the holy place and the most holy, and very sparse furniture inside, all the way back to the tabernacle times. And so this is a much bigger structure than it needed to be, but what actually wraps those two holy rooms would be storerooms, because you remember people from all over Israel are bringing tithes in. They would be bringing in supplies for the priests, to be used for the priests. And so there's three stories. The temple had three stories of storage rooms and cells around it used for storage. And then around the temple, this whole structure, there was a whole complex of individual rooms and cells. There were 16 different rooms. There was one on each corner. This one is called the Chamber of Hewn Stone, and that's where the Sanhedrin met. When the judicial system met, that was where they met. Each one of them had a different name, a different purpose, and we don't need to go into all those at this time. But that's how the temple was set up itself. Now, in Mark chapter 13, verse 1, it says, "As he was going out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, 'Teacher, behold what wonderful stones at what wonderful buildings.'" And he used the plural of buildings because there was much more than just the little temple itself. It was all these other buildings that made up the whole structure, the whole architecture. And you remember Jesus said in verse 2 of Mark 13, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left upon another which will not be torn down." Of course, he's referring to the Romans when they would finally take Jerusalem and destroy the temple. And so excavations. Now this is south of the Western Wall or the Wailing Wall. This is where they've actually dug all the way down to first century street. So this is a street that Jesus and the disciples would have walked on. And you can see the stones that have been pushed over by the Romans. Those were buried for centuries and they were excavated. And so that shows what Jesus prophesied here in Mark chapter 13. There's also on the structure you're seeing over here. Remember, this is a street. This is the temple wall. And so this structure over here are individual shops. There's what have been that's where things should have been sold. Each one of those would have been a storekeeper of some kind, selling some kind of merchandise. Now that would have been where people should have been selling things. As I said, many of these stones have been repurposed over the centuries. These, of course, were left and were buried over time. Once you're on top of the Temple Mount, you are in the temple. It was a holy precinct. It was a place of reverence, of study, of worship and prayer. Jesus and later the apostles, they taught in those colonnades that wrapped the whole Temple Mount. And of course, that was a huge area. Any number of people could have met at the same time in all different areas around that colonnade. It would have accommodated a lot. So down here would have been legal. Up in the Temple Mount, it was where the problem existed. So where there's an opportunity for profit, there also exists a temptation for abuses. And so it's logical to assume that these abuses probably happened in the royal stoa and the court of the Gentiles in that southern area before you got to the wall, prohibiting you from going any further. More than likely, if it's in the temple, it had to have been there. The temple authorities, specifically the Sadducees, they're in control at this time of Jesus. They would have been well aware of this business going on. In fact, they probably sanctioned it and possibly even got cuts of the prophets. The prayers and the discussions of Scripture would be competing with the bleating of sheep, the lowing of cattle, the cooing of doves. They would have had plenty of room in the royal stoa to pen up a lot of animals. It's a massive space. So thousands of Jews are traveling to Jerusalem to worship for these festivals, and they would require a significant number of animals. So you can just imagine the mess. I think this picture kind of gives you an inkling of what it must have been like. The smells, the sounds of all defiling this most holy place. On top of the animal business that was going on, there were other transactions taking place. Every Jewish male entered the temple had supposed to pay a temple tax of one-half shekel. And, of course, this predates the temple. This goes back to Exodus 30, where males 20 and up were supposed to pay a half shekel into the Lord's treasury. So in Exodus 38, it gives the specification on the standard to be used. It was to be a sanctuary shekel. And so it was decreed by authorities that this currency that was paid, it had to be in a certain coinage so that it didn't defile, didn't present a defilement. And so obviously Jews coming from all over the world would have all kinds of money in their purses. All of that would have had to have been converted. Much like we do today when we go to another country, we have to convert our currency into their currency, and there's usually a surcharge, some kind of a fee that you have to pay. Here's another opportunity for abuses. And so you get to Jerusalem to worship. You have to pay the tax and a specific coin, and you have to make this transaction. What do? If you're going to be worshiping, you have to do that. And I might add that even today in Jerusalem, there's still money changers. So during the Passover, thousands upon thousands of people are streaming into Jerusalem. And so business in both of these areas, animals and these money changers, would have been brisk. Jesus arrived, and he's appalled at what's going on in the temple. This building we're in, this is not the church. It's not holy. It's just a building. The people who are coming here, who assemble here, of course, are the church. And they are to be holy. We are to be holy. And the worship that takes place here and the study that takes place here is to be holy. But even with that understanding, just imagine if out on the front porch and in the lobby, you had to walk through cages of animals. The smell, you've been to the state fair, you know what animals smell like in concentrated areas. People haggling over the cost of things. Imagine if people have set up tables and there's monetary transactions going on. It's more of an atmosphere of a marketplace or a bazaar. And as you enter, you have to navigate through that to get to the auditorium to engage in worship. Is that the kind of distraction that you'd want if you're coming to worship God? If you're trying to get your mind set on spiritual things? When you add in that place was considered holy. The precinct itself was considered holy, as well as all that was done there, how much more repugnant this situation was to Jesus. Now, what's interesting is, in all four Gospels where these incidences are recorded, none of them really mention Jesus' demeanor during this purging that he did at the temple. He's often depicted in movies and things as just this intense anger and rage that he goes into. But there's nothing that says anything about the emotions that he exhibited other than he was stopping what was going on in an abrupt way. And since we know Jesus never sinned, we can be assured that he did not lose his temper. He did not go out of control like he's often depicted. He was compelled to act immediately to put a stop to this. Jesus always knew and acted in the proper way, the proper response to every situation he encountered. And so we're told he made a whip. He made a whip of cords in order to drive the animals out. Can't you just imagine the mayhem that took place when he got going? Animals being released. They're running everywhere, escaping through passageways, down ramps, down staircases, dodging and weaving through people who are coming in. Cages falling, doors opening, birds flying, feathers flying. Animal keepers running after their animals. Next, Jesus turned over the tables. Stacks of coins spilling and clinking on stone pavement, rolling in all directions. Money changers at first jump back with surprise and start scurrying to collect their money. And Jesus' disciples witnessed Jesus doing this. And what came to their minds was Psalms 69, verse 9. Zeal for your house has consumed me. So here's an example of Jesus demonstrating righteous indignation. This unholy practice had to be stopped immediately. And he did what had to be done, what needed to be done. He needed to make a strong point, and he did it. Now, the other incident is much like bookends on his ministry. It took place just the week prior to his crucifixion. His first cleansing of the temple had been probably effective for a while, but the incentive for profit was just too great. The merchants have moved right back in, taken an opportunity on this occasion. Now, perhaps the lambs and the calves were no longer there. They're not mentioned. But doves were. They were permitted by the law, as well as the money changers are back. And so Jesus made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives on the colt of the donkey. He entered the temple in Mark 11 and verse 15. And again, he drives out those who were buying and selling. He topples their cages holding the doves. He turned over the tables of money again, spilling them all over the plaza. And again, the similar sight of cages opening and birds flying, feathers going everywhere, men dashing to collect their money. And Mark also adds another infraction that Jesus condemned. It says he would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. And the word there for merchandise can mean vessel, jar, or dish. And so it may or may not have referred to containers being sold. It's more likely that people were using the temple as a shortcut. You know, the streets of Jerusalem, this is just an artist's rendering, but these streets are very narrow. Both sides are shops with people with their tables and merchandise out. And even today, you can see how narrow they are. Can you imagine if you have your own merchandise and you're trying to get through town, and this is with nobody there. Imagine these, when it's packed with people, it's oppressive because it's so claustrophobic. So you have people who are trying to navigate through this. Why do that? Let's just cut across the temple. That'd be the easiest way to do it. Much less hassle to go that way. And there were plenty of access points to use, north, south, east, and west. But again, that wasn't the purpose of the temple. It wasn't a place. It was a place to honor and revere God in solemn worship. It wasn't a shortcut to save you steps and where you're going. And so for a time, Jesus put an end to that as well. Now, there's two passages in the Old Testament that the people involved in these cleansing had forgotten to honor. One of them is Isaiah chapter 49 and verse 6. He says, "It is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also make you a light of the nations so that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth." This is a messianic passage, but the principle is there that for the Jews as well. God told them at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19 that of all the peoples, he had chosen them, the descendants of Abraham, to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And that held tremendous implications. They didn't realize it, but it did. They were designated to be mediators and ambassadors of his message to the world. Their lives were to communicate the message of who God is. and point to who he is and what he is like. He is holy and righteous. God was bringing redemption to all nations through Abraham's seed. Israel wasn't to be alone in that redemption. And as Isaiah said in this passage, the Messiah was the light, not only for Israel, but also for the world, for the Gentiles. So the Jews should have been reflecting that example to the rest of the world. They were called to a higher mission. And was this how they demonstrate that higher mission? They turned their holy place into a common bazaar. They were doing business in their most sacred site, where God had placed his name. How frequently they were just the opposite. They were the bad examples to the heathen world. The second passage is Isaiah 56, verse 6 and 7. Also the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to minister to him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, everyone who keeps from profaning the Sabbath and holds fast my covenant, even those I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all the peoples. This looks at a time when foreigners would be coming to the holy mountain to worship the only true and living God. And they would gather in a house of prayer, he calls it. And that's what Jesus quoted on this occasion during this cleansing. And of course, this passage is also messianic. But it would have appeared to the foreigners, to the Romans, that the Jews were just as worldly as any other people. The same covetous activity was going on that you see in any pagan temple. The holy temple of God had been turned into an open-air market, filled with people only interested in money, hucksters, hustlers, all being condoned and benefited by their partners in crime, the religious authorities. It was no longer a house of prayer, Jesus said. In Mark 11 and verse 17, he called it a den of robbers, a den of thieves. So this harkens back to Jeremiah's words in chapter 7 and verse 11, when the very same attitude existed to Jeremiah's people that suggests it wasn't even honest business that was going on. It was fraudulent business where people are taking advantage of others under the guise of religion. So they were all spiritual reprobates, the whole lot of them. And then the religious authorities demanded of Jesus, by whose authority are you taking these liberties? They were furious at his actions to the point they wanted to kill him. And of course, that's when they started plotting on how they would pull that off. So what are some practical lessons that we can take away from these two occasions of Jesus cleansing the temple? First, we are surrounded by a plaza of worldliness. A society that has become profane. In contrast to the world, a Christian is to be holy, as God is holy. That's the life to which a Christian has been called. That's how we need to live our lives, striving to keep our hearts pure, following and reflecting God's righteousness, and pointing and leading others to him. That's the expectation. But often we let merchants and money changers in. Sometimes we compromise our holiness for the prophets of the world. Just like that day at the temple, they would have insisted that they were worshiping God. And if that's true, then why have you let all this stuff in? We can let stuff in and offer, try to justify it being there. Satan doesn't care if you completely rebel against God or not. He doesn't care if you become a complete reprobate. If he can just get you to set up one table, to bring in one cage, he chalks it up as a success. Are there tables in our lives that need to be overturned? Have you let worldly things into your life that need to be removed? And that's, of course, an assessment we need to make on a regular basis. It's easy to let things slip in if we're not vigilant. And that scrutiny is what is necessary. If you're going to be a true to God, be loyal to him, true to his word. There's some perfect passages in the New Testament that complement this idea. They liken the believer to a temple. Of course, one is in by Peter in 1 Peter 2 and verse 5. He said Christians are living stones being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Paul in 1 Corinthians 3:16 and 17, "Do you not know that you are a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, and that is what you are." So to be acceptable to God, the temple has to be kept pure. That's what Jesus did that day. So our temples, our bodies, we need to be, the way we live, we need to be pure and undefiled. And as Paul strongly states, failure to do so has dire consequences. I like what David said in Psalm 24. "Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not trust in an idol or swear by a false god." Secondly, it goes with the point that Isaiah emphasized. We must always remember that a child of God is to reflect God's light and his righteousness. Why? Well, first of all, to assure our own salvation. That should be reason enough. But also, so the profane world will see it. We are examples. They're to see our words and our deeds, that we're pointing, our lives are pointing to God. The Jews should have been doing that, being examples of what godly people are. Not just looking holy, not just a facade for show with some hypocritical unholiness underneath, but genuine, devoted hearts demonstrating holy lives, pointing the world to God. Instead, they became self-centered, they were arrogant, they were condescending, they developed a loathing for other nations. And we experience irreverence daily from the people that surround us. We see and hear God mocked, we see him ridiculed and blasphemed, and we cannot be a party to that. We need to set the example of what it means to be respectful and reverent. And that means showing respect and reverence for God, each individual that makes up the Godhead, and what their part was in our redemption. Respect and reverence for his word, for the church, for the acts of worship that we go through. To show respect and reverence for the institution of marriage, for the family, and the various roles that God has designated. And a respect and reverence for all people, demonstrating love towards all. We're God's ambassadors of the gospel to the world. And Jesus insisted on reverence and respect that day in those actions. I'll close with an example. Brother Sewell Hall held a meeting here years ago, and it really stuck with me. If we were to chart our spirituality, the top line is God's standard of holiness. That's what he expects Christians to reach for and to maintain. He's set the bar. The bottom line is the morality and spirituality of the world. And at times it's better than others, but it's always well below what God's standard is. So where are you? Is that your standard? Are you just above the world? Do you look religious? Do you justify yourself by saying, "Well, I don't commit that sin," or "I would never do that," or "I'd never stoop that low. At least I'm not as bad as that worldly person." You're just a few steps above the worldly standard. Do you think that's pleasing to God? Do you think that's what he expects of his people? A holy child of God, a temple of God, he reaches for that top line. And if the world drops lower, we don't flinch. We don't fluctuate. We match God's standard. Why? Well, first and foremost, to please and honor him, because that's what he deserves. And the standard is for our benefit. God promises eternal blessings for those who will follow his standard. And we do it so the world will see where our loyalties lie. So they'll see that we have a holy life that's dedicated to God. That's what that life looks like, one that's dedicated to God. And we do it to be an example that influences others to live the same way. Hopefully they will come to realize the eternal benefits that we have. So do you need to put on Christ in baptism? Do you need to clean out worldliness in your life? Repent of your sins, confess your belief in Jesus, be buried with him in baptism. That's how you become into Christ, get into Christ. That's how you start showing your loyalty to God, your commitment to God and your life, and living by His standard, following at that top bar as closely as you can. Or if you've fallen below God's standard, I encourage you to strive to bring your life back up to where God expects it to be. And of course, we'll always pray for you and try to help you in any way you can. So if tonight, if you need to make your wishes known in any way that you might improve your relationship with God or to start a relationship with God, we hope you'll take advantage of this time while we're here tonight, while we stand and sing.